I'm Christopher Lydon with the novelist André Aciman. The New Yorker calls him an acute grammarian of desire. He's a writer of the rarest emotional refinement who makes me, and maybe you, stop and ask, where is this coming from? What is André Aciman up to? This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation with global attitude. We call it André Aciman. I come as that lowliest beast in the literary kingdom, the fan, but I really just wanted to find out how you do it, how you connect with a tradition of, as I feel it, Henry James, Dostoevsky, and especially Marcel Proust, how your publishers let you get away with it. What are we to make of an extraordinary degree of literacy, literateness in this world? What's the answer?
There is no answer. There's no one answer. It's basically where I was trained, how I was trained, what I got to love first. Whatever books you read first, you love the most and you never forget. And they basically define what you become and what you look for. I am trained in the most classical tradition imaginable, in the sense that the 19th century defines many of us writing today, not necessarily the 20th century. It's the 19th century that matters. But I went at them when I was extremely young enough to be impressed and impressionable, and yet naive enough not to understand what made them great. So I went to them in search of my own fears and my own insecurities. I was always astounded by Dostoevsky, not by his grand sort of narrative schemes and by his grand images of mankind and the whole salvation thing, which never interested me and still doesn't. What I was interested about Dostoevsky were his characters and their ability to look into each other and into themselves. I was always ultimately interested in introspection and the ability of certain characters to, through the act of introspection, to understand other people, sometimes with aggressive purposes and sometimes just to bridge themselves to them. And so I found that by the time I was 18, I had learned a great deal about people. Simply not because I encountered many characters, but because I had developed, by virtue of, say, reading somebody like Dostoevsky particularly.
Can I jump in on Dostoevsky? Yes. Because Eight White Nights, which captivates me so, your novel, is in so many ways an extension of his extraordinary story, White Nights, about a man who saves a woman from embarrassment, from an assault perhaps, falls insanely in love with her, 10,000 valves open in his heart, and at the end, she cannot break a betrothal to another man, and he is left holding the bag, so to speak. It is the outline, in many ways, of your vastly expanded examination of that frustration, that heartbreak. But it's just the beginning of the ways you extend another tradition. So much of Henry James's Beast in the Jungle mm-hmm. is in this story of a man who cannot love and will not step across the room to save the life of the woman he adores for some reason of inner blockage, maybe his whole sexuality. But in any event, these are the frames that you're working in today.
Yes. The Dostoevsky was not as profound an influence, say, as The Idiot was. That's more the character I associate myself with. Not because I'm an idiot, but because...
Neither was Mishkin.
But it was more... It was his sense of being totally adrift in the world. He was not only dysfunctional, he was totally adrift. He didn't quite belong, didn't know. And everybody's telling him all the time, you know, what they say behind his back is immaterial. It's what they tell him. You know, you're okay. You're like us. You're one of us. Come and have dinner. Come and have lunch. And he belongs, but he doesn't belong. The problem with James is very different. Henry James, I think, is I think he's incapable of feeling anything, which is why I'm not a fan of James. I'm too Mediterranean to have any patience with
him. I sort of disagree on the matter of feeling. But
yeah. Well, no, it's a feeling.
I'm always fighting that teacup label on Henry James, you know, yeah. The little pinky raised. It's not him at all, I think, but...
No, but I don't think he feels anything below the heart. And I mean not, don't mean down there. I mean in the tripe, in the gut. There's a sense of gutlessness about Henry James. I don't feel there's anything, you know, between the hip and the heart. There's no organ there. There's no digestive system. There's no peristaltic system. There's none of that. Whereas I think that a person like Proust, on the other hand, feels things very much in that area, in the tummy, as it were, where the liver is and where the bile is and so on. And of course, everybody thinks a lot in Dostoevsky, in James, in Proust. They all think. And I think that thinking is itself not only, doesn't only participate in inhibition, but it's a product of an inhibition as well. And so the character in my novel who has no name and possibly not much of an identity, like Dostoevsky's, is inhibited. But not because he doesn't feel it. And not because he doesn't feel desire. And not because he doesn't feel almost impelled to her, as he does show on occasion. And she is the same way. They have something holding them back. And the reason is not explained in the book. And I don't think that you need a reason. The essential reason is that in all of us, in all our lives, we've had either one or a continuous, ongoing state of uncertainty and fear of the other, which holds us back. And those, ultimately, are sometimes, when you look back, are the relations that mattered or, to put it in the tense of the book, could have mattered.
I wish you'd read almost anything from this novel, Eight White Nights, but I could suggest places. This is about a man who meets a woman at a party on Christmas Eve. She says, "I am Clara," and he is bewitched from that moment. But he's also frozen, and they meet for 8 nights. We're not quite sure what happens after that, but this is an asymptotic relationship in the sense of that, right, that graph that never reaches the axis, but it gets closer and closer and closer. And there's an incredible vitality between them, and yet maybe a doomed sterility, too.
But they are libidinous. I mean, terribly so.
But almost without touching and with one or two kisses in the week.
Well, she does reach into his pants.
There's a passage in The Fourth Night where he buys her a CD.
Yes. "I walked into Starbucks, ordered the same coffee infused with mocha she had brought me along yesterday, and opened one CD box after the other. I liked the post-Christmas crowd, tourists milling around Lincoln Center, and so many New Yorkers off for the day. I still had 2 presents to buy. Then I realized that what I truly wanted to do was to buy Clara a present. Why buy me a present? Because... because is a terrible reason. Because you changed everything. Because as soon as you touch a day in my life, it changes color, like one of those mood rings. Because if you so much as graze my skin, that part of me is burned forever. Here, see this elbow? You tapped it once when we walked by the bar the other night. It hasn't forgotten. See this hand? It held the tips of all your fingers when you cried. And as for my forehead, you once said you liked it, and ever since my thoughts are no longer the same. Because you make me like my life, who I am, and if everything stops here, not to have met you would be like having lived in a north country and never tasted a single tropical fruit. Cherry moya, mango, guava, papaya, I'll name them all like the stations of the cross, or the towns to Compostela, or the stations on the Broadway local line, including the ghost station under 91st Street, which is where you and I, Clara, drink of the same blood, like two shades from the underworld who need to time out together before heading back to what are called the living."
It's funny because these are sometimes very unlovable people. They're solipsistic. They have no work. They're rather idle. And yet they're incredibly winsome. And when they reflect on their own excitement about love, they're almost an ideal. Are they not?
I think that's what, if you want to call it art, that's what art does. It takes the ordinary, the absolutely ordinary day-to-day humdrum stuff the stuff we ignore, and it magnifies it and keeps magnifying it and magnifies it again and again and again, till it, not till it swells and explodes, but till it becomes big enough for you to finally see what it is that your day was like under a microscope, without being, I think, obsessive, or without being, without uglifying the whole picture, mm-hmm. because you can distort by virtue of getting closer and closer. But I think when you think about it, most of us, when we meet someone that truly shakes us up, and they can, we still meet them when they shake us up. We could be 100 years old and they'll still shake us up. My father was 93 when he died, and yet he could be shaken up by a woman. He would talk about a woman that he met in a cafe and begin talking about her.
Good for him.
And basically, it doesn't stop, and it shouldn't stop. If you become too wise, then you're dead anyway. But he taught me something, that the most important things in life are the small ones. And it's important to observe them, with even with fussiness, because you want to see these things. And that's what I devote my life to, is to observing these small things. The dialogues that I entertain with people in my head are far more erotic than the ones I'll have with them. Most people will tell me things that I can write for them. Mm. That I could script. They're scripted speeches. Most people that I meet are telling me things that are supposed to turn me on, but they don't, because basically they're just spouting one cliche after another. Seldom am I surprised. But what I write for them, now that's really magnificent stuff. So, and I find them more interesting the more time I've spent with them in my mind. I could meet somebody who's totally ordinary, and by virtue of having thought about them a tiny bit, become eroticized the next day when I meet them because of what I've thought about.
You're not simply undressing them.
Oh, you do undress them. You do undress them.
Then what?
And you might rape them if you want. You might sort of jump on them, or you hope they jump on you. Whatever. I mean, these are the things, that the internal dialogues that we all carry on constantly. What should I have said? Maybe I should have said such and such. Yes, but then she would have said such. And yes, but what if she had said that? Then I would have said that. And then what? Well, then we'll see. And then you go back again and you repeat it, because that's what the character in the novel does all the time. He goes back and replays the dialogue, or wished it had gone there, as when he's sitting in the park in the snow and he imagines that he's cut his finger and is bleeding. And he's thinking that Clara will come from the party all the way to the park and wrap his finger in her shirt so that he would stop bleeding. And what an erotic moment that is, because it's really not his finger that is bleeding, and it's really not her shirt. He wants to undress her, etc., etc. I leave it the rest to your imagination.
Endlessly in the book, she said this, but what she meant was that. Or what he was really thinking was something else. Should he call her? Has she called? Has she left a message? Mm-hmm. Will she call? Why not? Should he call her to get revenge? Should he not call her to get revenge? These things spin out endlessly, but also to a point of, wait, is somebody disabled here?
It would be so easy to use the word neurotic. It would be so easy. And it would be so, because once you use the word neurotic, as so many people have done, I was once interviewed by a good friend, and he used the word neurotic. And of course, the moment you use the word neurotic, everything gels around it, and you cannot get past that. And I've never used the word neurotic in my book. I would never. I don't even use the word love that frequently, because I don't like these big words. They kind of, to a writer, it's the biggest crime. It's like when you're a painter and you want to paint passion, don't use red. Because once you do that, you've basically shot your wad. There's nothing left to say. You want to hold off on the red. You want to hold off on the keyword and see what comes out and see how else you can work around it. It's not, I mean, yes, he is neurotic, but then, you know, look at Manhattan. I mean, it's all made up of neurotic individuals. Everybody's sick and twisted, and very twisted. And everybody hesitates. I mean, think about it. I give you my number and I am flirting with you and I say, call me. Okay, I've given you a green light. So now you can call me. But guess what? You call me the first time, or I call you the first time, and I'm shaking and I'm nervous, and I hope you don't answer. Though I hope you answer, because then I have to deal with the answering machine. And do I leave a message or don't I leave it? And what kind of a message do I leave? Do I have an uppity attitude or a downcast one? How do I want to sound? And then finally you pick up the phone and I'm disappointed, because now I have to invite you for dinner. And that's what I want, but I'm too nervous. So, as happens so often, you know, you say, okay, fourth ring, they didn't pick up, they don't want me to call, you hang up. But then you say no, then you go back. And I think every single human being doesn't only go through that, but they live life that way. Except nobody will tell you that. And they certainly won't tell you that in the locker room, where everybody's busy being sort of macho. There's only two kinds of things one can say in a locker room. One is, what position do you use and how many times? That's the second thing. And everybody's boasting. And nobody tells you that they were scared to death, because the fear is always there. And there's another thing that nobody talks about, and I didn't talk about it, but I wanted to suggest it, is that there's something, we all have been brainwashed into thinking that sex is good, that sex is clean, there's nothing dirty about sex. And we want to believe that, and I certainly do, but in the back of my mind, there's always that reluctance, that sense of, I'm crossing a line with sex, am I not? There's something naughty in sex. I want it to be naughty. I don't want it to be totally sort of bereft of that. But at the same time, there's a discomfort with desire, which nobody talks about. And yet it's there. It spells how we behave vis-a-vis the people whose body we are dying to touch.
Your girl Clara in the novel Eight White Nights is an incredible gift for the short message that invariably is witty, is tantalizing, but almost always fends off, stops the conversation, is the hand up.
Right.
Slow down.
It's cruel, too. She is,
yes,
caustic. And I think that's the real word I wanted to use. This is a girl who basically, no woman can understand why Clara is attractive. They hate her because she is everything that they hope women are not. And yet, no man needs to be persuaded of why Clara is so... It's like the devil. She's totally attractive because we know women. We haven't met many Claras, but we've all met one at least. And we know what our defenses are totally down, because she sees the little boy in every grown-up man. And she calls him by that. She reduces him to the kind of fuddling human being he is. He wants to be a man. He wants to show off. And she reduces him to an early teenager. He's just callow.
Does the author know what she wants?
Does the author know what she wants? No.
The answer we're looking for is Proust. So what is the question?
Actually, there's less Proust in here than meets the eye. I've written about Proust a lot, so everybody automatically makes the assumption. Proust understood one form of desire, not physical necessarily. I don't think he ever wrote about physical desire vis-a-vis another human being. He just doesn't know how to describe that. He will describe you how they look, but there is no libido in how he describes. But he understood jealousy. He understood, I want you, why are you not with me? Why are you with somebody else? What are you doing when you're not with me? That's what he understood. Mm. I am not that way. I don't understand jealousy. I'm not interested in it. The character in the book, when he suspects she's with another man, does not get it, is not really jealous. I mean, he should be, perhaps, but that's not where his mind goes, and that's not where mine goes either. So in that respect, desire in Proust is totally different. But the way you look at experience may be very similar.
Come back to Proust, if only because I've read you on Proust. You've collected views of Proust. You worship Proust the way the Proustians do. How does he work in your head as a writer? And how do you see him working in the heads of us readers?
Well, a good Proustian reader, the bad Proustians are the people who read him for the social commentary. In other words, the class thing, which is interesting up to a certain point, it is interesting. But I've always found it very boring and tedious, and I just skip over it.
And you don't imitate it at all in your novels, I notice.
No, I'm not interested in. I'm interested in how two human. I mean, that's why I love French literature, and Proust is very much in that tradition. You don't need an Atlantic Ocean. You don't need Moby Dick. You don't need whales. You need a room like this one, small, with two individuals, sometimes three, just to make it a bit, give us diversity. But basically, two individuals sitting in one room with the impossibility of going to for sex. So that's not part of the formula. It will come. Eventually, we're both thinking of it, but not right now, says the script. And in these two individuals sitting in a room are basically having a conversation. Mm. And it has to be an intimate conversation, a personal conversation, about the very good things of life. And that's good enough. And there are tensions, and examining and talking about the tension. And Proust is a master of this, of putting individuals together, or remove one individual. You have one individual by himself, thinking about experience and trying to be as honest as he can with himself and therefore with the reader about the things that crossed his mind and how he dealt with them and how he thinks experience works, how he thinks the weather works. Is there an intention in the weather? No, of course we know there's no intention in weather, but sometimes you almost feel it does. Every time you have a date, it snows. So obviously something out there is against you. And Proust knows that's not the case, but he can't help but tell you that maybe there might be. And so he begins to explore this. No magical thinking, no, magical realism, none of that stuff. I have no patience for that. But it's being as honest as you can to what is it that our lives are about, moment by moment by moment, because that's our life. The rest is just, as I like to say, just prose. And we have a lot of masters of just prose living today.
And yet few like Proust. I know, of course, the English translation, the Moncrief, but those sentences, those paragraphs, those pages, I'm always reminded of something Norman Mailer said in response actually to a joke. We were joking about, I think it was Ezra Pound's line, that if all the music we had in the world was Bach, we'd have enough. If all the literature we had in the world was Homer, we'd have enough.
True.
And Norman Mailer paused, but he looked stricken, as if I'd slapped him. And he said, "Chris, what about Proust?" And to me, the interesting thing about it afterward was he didn't say, "What about Shakespeare?" Or "What about Dante?" Or "What about me?" He said, "What about Proust?" Like, you would not want a world without that kind of ultimate refinement of language and emotional observation and introspection, and what is the meaning of the musical line or the painted line or the color or the horizon or the girl on the beach, the girl up close, etc. The endlessness of it. Mm-hmm. It is a treasure like none other. But I'd love to hear your version.
For me, it's not Proust, though I worship Proust. The writer, I think I will never be able... I can write like Proust if I want to. It's not difficult to imitate. No, it's easy. It's really not that difficult. It's like Picasso. He could paint like Velázquez if he wanted to, but he didn't want... But there is one writer I will never get close to, and he is really my favorite, and it's Thucydides. The Peloponnesian War, probably the most profoundest, most disturbing book ever written. And nobody reads it because it's...
Read it and we talk about it on the radio.
You do?
Yeah.
Good for you. It's the most profound book I have ever read. And the portrait of human beings is ruthless and merciless because he goes right into their guts. Mm. And even Proust couldn't go that deep. But Thucydides knows how to do that. And the portrait of human stupidity is sort of unmatched.
Human frailty, human brutality. There was an officer working under Petraeus in the counterinsurgency manual who had studied Thucydides at West Point, and he said to us on the radio, it was quite striking, he said, "Read the civil war in Corcyra in Thucydides," and he says, speaking about Iraq, of course, you can see the drill bits in the head. What happens when a civilized society falls apart, breaks? It's all in Thucydides, in a way.
No, I think it's a great book, but I know the style is, I studied some ancient Greek, and I know I could never translate, certainly not the speeches in Thucydides. They're impossible to translate. So he was a great, great, great writer. But the Proustian sentence is itself quite a, not just a challenge, but it's a way of capturing, I think the human soul, the human experience in one sentence every single time to capture basically my reaching out to the world, colliding with the world, hitting myself on the head for missing what was so obvious, and then sort of retreating into myself, like, okay, that was sentence one. Let's go to sentence two. Same move.
He has so many moves. I mean, I think of his endless pages on his childhood disentanglement from Gilberte, with whom he's insanely in love. We don't, and she's tired of him.
Yes.
And he realizes that he's going to have to kill that person in himself that is so infatuated with this little girl.
Right. He does that all the time, by the way.
Yeah.
And he doesn't, because he's afraid of, what I call experience. He's afraid of the pain that comes from wanting other people. So he wants to choke it. He'll figure out a way to choke it. And the best way to do it is to write about it or to go to writing in order to exercise this thing. And what happens is that he's honest enough every time he depletes his soul that way to tell you that 2 years later I was in my bedroom taking off my shoes when suddenly I burst out crying. And I didn't know why I was crying, but I suddenly remembered in this very room my grandmother, when she used to be alive, had taken off my shoes for me. And he sobs like crazy. Mm. But you see, the beauty of Proust is that he's so honest. And in Proust, you have a sense that everything he's going to tell you is going to be for him a first. And it becomes a first for you, even though you've thought about it all your life, which is the other wonder of Proust. Nothing he tells you, you haven't thought about. You just never took the time out to focus, or you were too embarrassed to stay on it for too long.
What is the trick, and you practice it yourself, of persuading the reader that it's not even about Marcel or Gilberte, it's about me?
It's about me. Oh, it's always about, yes, it is. It's about us. I think that's the genius of Proust. If there's a genius, that's where it is that he's writing a book about himself. He's rich, he's spoiled, he's sickly, he's asthmatic, he basically loves his mommy too much, his Grammy is in the way, his father is not so hot. He's telling us all these things that most of us don't know. How many of us are that privileged to be living on the Champs-Élysées or right next to the Champs-Élysées? He's got this life that nobody knows anything about. And yet, it's really our lives. We don't have a garden. We don't have that many servants. We don't even have a servant. But we understand what it is to be cruel to a chicken and yet to produce a fantastic sauce. You see what I'm saying? I mean, we understand Françoise even though you may never have had a maid in your life. That's not the point. The point is that you understand that there's a question of, there's a humanity in Proust that open, and he knew it. Said, you know, basically I'm writing this about me, but if it's not about you, then I've missed the boat.
How do you do it? How do you persuade me that the indecision, the hesitations, the love, the lust, the ambition of your unnamed boy in Eight White Nights is me?
It's complicated. Well, you have to do it with cadence. I mean, that's really the trick. It's not really a trick. It's the way that you approach experience. Is if you have the cadence, or the cadence you think is the right one for this particular book, if you've made it through the cadence, you've articulated to yourself what is the mood of the sentence going to be. If I stay on that mood, then probably the things it's going to make me say are going to be of one ilk throughout the whole book. And if you are not captured by that sentence structure, by that cadence, you find it insufferable, then the book cannot speak to you. But if you've allowed yourself and you've accepted the cadence of the sentence, then it becomes the rhythm of your heart. It becomes the rhythm of your body. It becomes your own pulse. We have basically traded blood. If you are willing to accept the first, I mean, the first paragraph of this book is intentionally aimed to put off a reader. It says, if you cannot make it through the first page, do not buy this book, put it back. And it's there when you go to Amazon, it's, you look at the book, it's the first sentence. I cannot stand this voice. Put it back, it's not going to get any better. But if you accept the cadence of that vision, then you're saying, this is mine. I understand what it is like to go to a party in which you had come earlier because this is really too late, or that you had waited a while later, or that you had not gone there at all because this is a waste of my time. And I'm ready to pack up and leave when suddenly somebody turns and says, hey, I'm Clara. What do you do now? Okay, now I've got to revisit the whole thing.
We're sitting here in the City University of New York, and I'm wondering, do you teach this? Where did you learn it? How many people practice prose the way you do?
Nobody. Nobody wants to. There are many reasons why. One is because, this is going to sound very self-serving, but I'll say it anyway. It takes a lot of courage. It takes a great deal of courage to write outside of magazine-y English, out of newspaperese, out of anything that's already templated out there. You know very well what the great magazines are looking for. Young writers are already aiming for the magazines and the short story collections. They know exactly what the publishers want and what the book publishers are going to look for in the magazines before they give you a contract for a collection of short stories, which I can't stand. I hate short stories. They're idiotic forms. It's an expendable way to write literature. No great writer.
To read or for you to write?
It's expendable. In other words, it's you read it 1 week, then you throw it out. You hope you'll see it again in a larger form. No, my hostility vis-a-vis the genre is not... No, let's go back to the original question, which is, what is it that is being asked of a writer today? And it's a horrible thing that is being asked for. You're supposed to write to mime the literary gesture so that the magazine can feel good about itself or themselves in producing literature and not just schlock. But it's a mimed literary gesture. They're all writing within a convention that passes for literature. It's not.
What makes it over the threshold for you? As literature being produced today, in this country, in the world?
Style. Style. If you have no style, don't even bother. If you don't have a style, if you haven't worked for a style, you shouldn't bother. Substance alone is not interesting. Certainly not for me. You might as well read a newspaper and find out from a magazine, you know, what happened in Tripoli this week. You want to get the real hardcore details of how those five reporters were beaten and held and what kind of fears they experienced. Blah, 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 blah. That's magazine language. It's not literature.
Funny you should mention it, though. Pretty good writing, all the more, I thought, because it was done in an earthy, fast way on deadline and, like, tell us what happened.
Yes, but then why would a good writer write this way? Earthy and tell it within a certain deadline. Doesn't work that way.
Well, it's one form. But I thought that report had an amazing energy.
It was very good. It was a very good story. It was fantastic. I read the same article you read. I read it this morning. I read it last night when I looked online and saw how beaten up they were, how they were tortured, how they were scared that they were
going to... How often do you hear a woman whispering to her colleague saying, I hope I don't get raped?
No, well, that's powerful stuff.
Yeah.
It's great journalism. It's what I call prose. That's all it is. Mm. It's not the other stuff. The other stuff is really difficult. And it looks for different issues. It's not going to go there. I mean, I'm not going to name the authors, but there are plenty of authors who wished they had written that story and will turn it into... How many authors have devoted the past 3 years or 4 years to writing around and about, you know, 9/11? as if it's a subject for, because it's a disturbing and perturbing thing. It's a horrible thing. And everybody has to deal with it. And it's part of our lives. It's part of New York. It's part of the current state of affairs. And I'm being faulted by reviewers for not even mentioning it. I'm writing about Manhattan. It's 100 blocks from Ground Zero. And you don't even mention this? Where are you living? What kind of idiotic thing is that to tell an author that doesn't want to have truck with the here and now? Because the here and now, if it's portrayed as here and now, is insignificant.
Who set your standard of style, and then when did you feel you were approaching it?
This is sounding horrible. My father. Hmm. My father was a man who had always wanted to be a writer. But he once told me when I was very young, he said, you know, you should really read Proust, but you're too young. If you read Proust, you will see what he does with a sentence. It's a long sentence, not short, like the ones you write. Okay? It's a long sentence that keeps you waiting. Keeps you waiting. And that, just that very thought of keep you waiting was what sort of crystallize in my mind. And of course, it took me years to realize what that meant, because you can see a long sentence, but you don't understand the abeyance that is being built into it and that sort of courts the reader into holding his breath and waiting and staying underwater and not feeling that you're going to drown. That takes time. And once you realize that, as I said, I like style. I also admire E.M. Forster. A great stylist who doesn't seem to have any style that's peculiar, but that's because he's a great craftsman. You can sense from the first sentence, and I judge books that way, the first sentence will tell me right away, does this author have it or does he not, or does she not? You can fool me by the first sentence, but by the second I know right away.
We know who you don't like. Who do you read with pleasure in the world today?
I don't think I like any writer writing today, I'll be very honest. Once in a while, I think that the great writers of the 20th century, basically Marguerite Yourcenar was absolutely genius, a brilliant, brilliant writer.
Memoirs of Hadrian.
Yes.
Marvelous book.
Absolutely magnificent. And basically, I think stops. Everything stops there with France. There's nothing else that came out after that in France. In the French language. In Italy, it's the Leopard. After that, nothing else. I think the only writer that I was sort of got to like, and he died too soon, was Sebald, the emigrants, Austerlitz. There was a man doing very interesting stuff and good stuff and quality stuff. And he was being honest and he was going after something that only he could do. It wasn't newspaperies and it wasn't magazine-y. And it took a lot of courage to do what he did. Even though nothing he wrote about was significantly bold, it wasn't meant to be bold. And I don't think that Out of Eight White Nights is in any way a bold book, because nothing and none of the subject matter is bold. There's a bit of phone sex, but that's about it.
Where do you look for fun, for promising stuff?
Well, you can find it anywhere. I mean, there's no reason to look for one place or another. I'm always looking. I'm always eager to, you see, because in the back of me, there's always this person who's dying to learn. I want to find something that will not only teach me something new, I want to be enchanted. I was enchanted when somebody said to me, you should listen to Arvo Pärt or to Schnittke. I had never heard of these two. A student of mine about 5 years ago said, you should listen to this, you might like it. Arvo what? I'd never heard of Arvo Pärt or of Schnittke. So I went and I took some stuff out and I listened to it and I said, this takes time. But of course this stuff is fantastic. Knightwood, a book that I discovered by pure happenstance, probably one of the best books written this century, last century in America. The most beautiful English ever written. Unmatchable. Even Joyce couldn't write this way. I mean, it's beautiful stuff. It's great stuff. I don't understand it. I don't know that she understood what she was saying or that she had a total sort of ear to what it is that the reader might be picking up. But it doesn't matter. The important thing is that I love finding stuff that is fantastic. A Quintet by Shostakovich. I'd never heard it before. Discovered it by chance. what a fantastic piece of music. So I'm always on the lookout, and I want to find writers that are fantastic. That's how I discovered Sebald or Kazantzakis. I mean, there are certain writers you discover, and you're happy that you have, because your life is enriched tenfold, hundredfold, because you rediscover what the magic of books are. But not recently, not recently. And there's a craze out there of writers that are supposed to be fantastic. And you look at the stuff, you look at the first page, my God, this is terrible. This is bad writing. Why is it good?
Andrew Ashman, speak about New York as the setting of Eight White Nights. Yours is not a New York accent. It's a very particular Upper West Side New York, and yet it's also a very abstract place. We don't know a lot about the real social circumstances. We know about two hearts in conflict, as Faulkner said, with themselves. What does New York mean to you?
New York is basically, retrospectively speaking, it's become my home. It is my home. It has probably always been my home. It's the only place I can live in, because it's the only place where too many different types can live together. I'm not going to give you the typical diversity talk, multinational, multi-ethnic, multi-whatever. It's not that. It's the fact that in New York, difference exists between individuals, period. Mm. Everybody's different, and there's no cohesion. In other words, you want to walk in the middle of the street, you can. You want to cross it when there's a red light, you can. You can walk and ride against traffic. It's all fine. You go to other places in the States, the entire United States, and if you walk and are not in a car, people will look at you or shut their doors because they're afraid you're a vagrant. But that's New York is a place for unhinged people. And I'm totally unhinged as a human being and sort of by my background.
Remind us where you came from and how you got here. When?
Oh, I got here. I come from Egypt. I was born in Egypt. I'm Jewish, and therefore I was kicked out of Egypt for being Jewish and for being European. I lived in Europe for a while, and then I came to America at the age of 17. And this became my home. It was never my home. There are days when I feel it's not and could never be my home. It's the best I can do, and it's, I think, the best the world can do for me. New York, after all, is a magical place, and there are days when New York pleases me because it reminds me that it has a certain beauty. I've said elsewhere that the beauty that I see in New York reminds me of other places, but then maybe I like New York for this reason more than the other places it reminds me of.
I went to see Strauss Park today, which is the kind of center of the scene of this novel. Strauss Park, named for a couple that died on the Titanic. I was reminded of Paris, especially looking uptown.
Well, if you look downtown, you'll remember London. And you turn around and it's Amsterdam. And you look down 106th Street and you go towards the park and you say, my God, behind the trees when they're in bloom, you know, or when they have leaves, you say, my God, it's the Mediterranean. The sea is right there. I know it is. So, in a sense, the beauty of Strauss Park for me is it's basically a ersatz capital for me. Mm. And it works for me. And that's why I wanted the book to take place in Strauss Park.
Andrew Ashman, it's so generous of you to let us drop in and listen and learn something and say thank you for your wonderful work, and thank you for this conversation.
Thank you for being here.
Ben Mandelkern produced and edited this conversation. It isn't over until you feed back on our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Leiden. Thank you for being part of the conversation.